While many are familiar with the call for one love from the music of Bob Marley, they more than likely know little about the tradition that this message is rooted in. In Rastafari and the Arts, an introduction, Darren Middleton introduces his readers to Rastafari through the creative expressions of its members in literature, art, film, and music. He traces the development of the tradition in Jamaica and abroad, including Ghana, Britain, and Japan, as well as highlighting key narrative, doctrinal, social, and ethical teachings. In our conversation, we discussed Haile Selassie, Rastafari and gender, the literary tradition of insiders and outsiders, the notion of Babylon, the great masters of dub poetry, including Mutu Baruka and Benjamin Zephaniah, documentary film, the role of reggae and Rastafari in Japanese culture, ethnographic work in Ghana, British Rastas, Bob Marley, and the commodification of Rastafari. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Darren Middleton. Welcome, Darren. Thanks for joining us on New Books in Religion. How are you this morning?
Thank you. I'm doing just great. Thanks.
So thanks for writing a wonderful book, Rastafari and the Arts, an introduction. This is a really great series of chapters. You take a really interesting approach to both the study of Rastafari and the way you put together your book. So I thank you for that, and I hope lots of people will pick it up.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Before we get into the details of the book, perhaps you could give us a little bit of background on how you got interested in the study of religion more generally, perhaps mentors or moments that were influential in bringing you to the study of religion and specifically to the study of Rastafari.
Sure. This is my 18th year at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, and where I teach a variety of courses in religion and the arts. And before that, I spent 5 lovely years at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. My wife is actually from Memphis, but I got to Memphis by a kind of long, circuitous route, and that would take us back to England. I was born and raised in Nottingham, in England, in the English kind of industrial East Midlands, and the son of a coal miner. And religion really did not play a very active or prominent role in my upbringing. My parents were not religious. In fact, my 3 older brothers were somewhat indifferent. One of them was fairly militantly opposed to it. So I can't really say that I had any kind of upbringing beyond the sort of standard one that most English school children have, which is since there is a state church, then there is a mandated teaching of religious studies from the ages of 5 through to the age of 16. And it was probably one of the only subjects I was actually fairly decent at. I was kind of interested in many of the philosophical and spiritual issues that came up in those classes. And colleagues here are often astounded when I tell them that I understood the synoptic problem, for example, at the age of 10, because that was, you know, I had a great teacher who was interested in telling us that the Gospels didn't fall straight out of the sky. They actually bubbled up from the human condition, as it were, such as it was in the first century. And here's the literary relationship and so on and so forth. And I was just fascinated by all of that. And started to read. I was a fairly bookish child, and read a lot of novels and read a lot of philosophy when I got into my teenage years. And believe it or not, I think I was reading Kierkegaard when I was about 15. So some of that stuff stuck with me. And I went from high school to the University of Manchester. I had some great mentors there, some of the best philosophical theologians that were in the United Kingdom in the mid-1980s were there. And David Palin was a really fine mentor of mine. He put me onto something that was unknown to me at the time, which was Christian process theology. And I was profoundly interested in some of the ways in which that influenced modern and postmodern Christian doctrine. From there, I went to the University of Oxford and took a master's degree with the late Maurice Wiles, who was at the time in retirement, but had been a very, very prominent Anglican theologian, chairman of the Doctrine Commission for the Church of England. Just a wonderful, kind, and patient soul. He'd have to be, really, to put it with me. But he did some excellent work, including the 1986 Bampton Lectures on what sense it makes to say that God acts in history, which was an issue that was perplexing me at the time. I was training for the ordained ministry in the United Kingdom, and in addition to reading sort of obtuse theology, I was also pastoring a congregation, and some of those folk in the congregation then, as now, wrestle with issues of what sense it makes to say that God acts in history, and the issue of prayer, and whether there is a particular providence in the world or whether there's a general providence. He guided me through that master's degree. What I started to learn at the end of that degree at Oxford was that a lot of my interest was sort of moving into fiction and literary art and visual art and musical art. And so I kind of stepped away from Oxford and then found my way to the University of Glasgow, where my doctoral supervisor, David Jasper, had relocated from Durham University. And he had set up the Center for the Study of Literature and Theology. And he, of course, has been the leading spokesperson for that broad field, if you can call it really a field, that there's so much that occurs within it. And he sort of gave me the tools to wrestle with a novelist who by that time was really quite fascinating to me, and that was Nikos Kazantzakis, the modern Greek novelist who many of you listeners perhaps will remember The Last Temptation of Christ, that was a very controversial film that Martin Scorsese directed towards the end of the 1980s, and maybe even Zorba the Greek, which Anthony Quinn made famous, of course. In terms of the study of religion in general, I think I've always been fascinated by the way in which religious people live, move, and function, really. I've always sort of been interested in it from two angles or two approaches, really. There's the confessional hat that I wear, of course. I'm very interested in what fellow Christians, since I count myself as one, are interested in saying and doing, both positive and negative. I'm very much invested in the confessional side and the doctrinal side, but there's also a very strong part of me that is interested in the social scientific, and sort of looking at it on a horizontal level and not just on a vertical level, as it were, and seeing what people do with religion, why they do it, how it becomes sometimes a unifying force for communities and sometimes the opposite. So that explains my interest in religion. If I can go back to Nottingham, however, that would probably explain how all my material on the Rastafari emerged, because and this will probably come as a surprise to some of those folk who read the book. I never took a formal course in the Rastafari. When I was interested in it, it was only because I grew up around many Rastafari in my part of England in the 70s and the 80s. Nottingham, as I mentioned, is an industrial city, and after the Second World War, when the immigration laws were relaxed in the United Kingdom, the British government practically took out full-page advertisements in the former Commonwealth countries, newspapers, and invited many sort of folk in those former Commonwealth countries to sort of come over and find a new life, and many did, and many had children, of course, and it was the children of those immigrants who came through who by the 70s were becoming attracted to this strong faith that became known as Rastafari. It took on a very sort of a social protest feel, as it were, in the 1970s for all sorts of reasons. But it also took on a very artistic feel with the music, largely through individuals like Bob Marley, who in many ways is reggae's global ambassador. In death as in life, but also a lot of local musicians as well, many of whom I sort of got to know and attended their concerts and so on. And I just became very interested, you know, who is this guy called Haile Selassie? What does he stand for, and why are there so many biblical references associated with him? So I just started asking questions, I guess, and the curiosity was piqued, and I took it from there. And it's been an avocational interest of mine ever since. I have to say that, and then I'll let you pose your next question. I have to say that my very first publication was actually on the Rastafari. I had a very kind mentor, Anthony Dyson, at the University of Manchester, who lamented that there was no course at the University of Manchester on the Rastafari, but he encouraged me to go to Jamaica, and I did so. I went to Jamaica and lived there for almost a year, moved around various seminaries and various homes of Baptist pastors and preachers and congregation members from back home, and did it all on the cheap, and managed to do some fairly basic, I guess what we would call ethnographic work now, and that led to an essay that I put together in 1989, and here I am still writing about it.
That's great. And when you read the book, you can definitely see your command over the scholarship. There's certainly no reason to lament over your not taking a class, because you've certainly mastered the scholarship for now. One of the really interesting parts of the book that I think is unique, and I want to just hear a little bit about why you chose to include this, is you have interviews throughout the book. Mm-hmm. What do you think these interviews bring to the book that isn't communicated in other ways? And how did this process go? Did you find it easy getting in touch with these people, having conversations with them?
It's a good question. I set out to sort of try and give the book its own authenticity. After so many years worth of on the ground experience with Rastas, not only in my hometown of Nottingham, but also here in the United States and in Africa and then even in Japan. You know, I was confident that I knew the material, and I appreciate your comment about the scholarship. I've tried to mine that as best as I am able, but I really wanted to let the reader know up front that I'm an outsider, obviously, to the movement, and anyone who does any study on the movement will quickly realize that insiders are often suspicious, rightly or wrongly, of outsiders, because some of the early material on the Rasta, scholarship material on the Rasta, was less than flattering and really somewhat bogus as scholarship, if I'm honest with you. I remember being at the University of West Indies in 1987 and going through some master's dissertations just to sort of get my bearings of what, you know, scholars and students were saying about the Rastafari, and was really quite surprised with some of the comments and that were attributed to them, and some of the beliefs that were attributed to them. Rastas have suffered from a misperception throughout their history, I think. And so I certainly didn't want to open myself up to that charge, that I was not taking them seriously enough. And so what I thought would be helpful was to sort of balance my outsider scholarship with some insider voices. And so I reached out to folk that I know. Some of them were unavailable or unwilling, and, you know, I respect that. But many of them actually were quite happy. Some of them were established poets, like Benjamin Zephaniah, who just a few votes shy of being Britain's poet laureate at one point in his career. He's a good friend of mine and was quite happy to let me use some of his poetry, which can be extraordinarily expensive when you have to pay permission fees. But he was also quite happy to sort of chime in with some timely and relevant comments on his understanding of reggae music and its place within the Rasta faith, and even his approach to Snoop Dogg's conversion to Snoop Lion at the time. He's quite the cultural critic. But then I also was able to check in with rising reggae stars like Asante Amen, who's really quite an amazing vocalist from Jamaica. And has signed an interesting sort of record deal and is bringing out new music even as we speak. He gave me a very interesting interview, should I say. And what was really fascinating about Asante is he is a baptized member of one of the smaller mansions or denominations within Rastafari, and one of the more fascinating and least studied, because it's one of the most recent. And so it was kind of interesting to pose some questions to him about that. I've also managed to feature a fairly lengthy interview with Barbara McCady Blake-Hanna, who actually will be a visitor to TCU's campus next April. She was basically the first insider to write a scholarly account of the Rastafari, a novelist in her own right, the first black journalist on British Channel 4 television, the only Rastafari independent opposition senator within the Jamaican Parliament, quite the elder statesperson within the Rastafari faith, and she is just an extraordinarily patient and kind woman. So I think if you add all those voices up, I think, as I mentioned a little earlier, they lend the book its own kind of authenticity, and hopefully, as I say early on in the book, readers will see that I've tried my best to balance outsider wisdom with insider insight, as it were.
Hmm. Yeah, I think you achieve that. It's a nice effect for the reader as well. So,
thank you.
So, just since we're kind of getting in deep here, in the first chapter, you use Ninian Smart's dimensional theory of religion, which gives us various aspects or dimensions, which he argues are essential to a tradition. And he uses this as a way to kind of explore some of the various teachings, perspectives, practices, organizational structures of Rastafari. Now, Rastafari is very diverse, but could you at least perhaps start to give us an idea for listeners who may not know much about the tradition? What is Rastafari all about?
Sure. I should sort of say, of course, that, you know, that right off the bat, Rastas that you speak to, they're all going to be very, very different, of course. And there are just as there are many Christianities, there are many Rastafari, and not all Rastafari think and act the same way. You can, as Benjamin Zephaniah points out in the book, he's often questioned about whether he's a true Rasta because he doesn't smoke marijuana, which of course, someone like Bob Marley did in copious amounts. You know, the Rastafari is constantly changing. You don't have to be a Rastafari to wear dreadlocks, for example, the matted hair in plaits or in locks. Some Rastas maintain you must. But so there's variety within the movement, which is not always picked up when people speak of Rastafarianism. As with Hinduism, it's a construct. It's a heuristic device that is both somewhat helpful but somewhat misleading. In terms of the Rastafari themselves, they'll often say that they are not a religion, they are a faith, or to use the language of the Rastafari, they are a liberty, a way of life, as it were, an experiential philosophy, a way of looking at the world and being within it, taking one stance within it. So I would want to say that. I'm in some ways, this is the outsider speaking again, in some ways imposing a structure on the Rastafari to sort of help certainly my students and then anyone who's reading the book to move beyond the idea that somehow Rasta is not a religion and therefore ought not to be taken seriously. What I want to do is try to reclaim something of the religious dimensions of the movement, and in that way then sort of get people to talk about the movement more thoughtfully. But back to Yanini and Smart, that I use the dimensions there really to sort of show, in just the same way that you can do it for Islam or for Judaism, that Rastafari shares in, actually multiple times over, many of those dimensions. Rastafari itself, the best way to start is to go to their central figure, and that is to go to the figure of Haile Selassie, the last emperor of Ethiopia, crowned in November of 1930, took many titles at his coronation, which was attended by a great many dignitaries from around the world. And one of those titles, actually one of the titles that piqued my interest back in my teenage years, when I first grew up around Rastas in Nottingham, one of those titles actually is King of Kings, Lord of Lords, Conquering Lion of the Tribe of Judah. And if you know your Bible, which I was learning a great deal about in my state-sponsored school class on religion, you would know that is a reference or an echo of Revelation chapter 5, verse 5. You go back in there and take a look at this rather mystical, strange document, you realize that most Christians, sort of refer or think that verse refers to Jesus of Nazareth, of course. The Rastafari interpret that text differently. So here, now, almost immediately, we have an example of the narrative dimension or the mythical dimension, because Rastafari will take that verse, Revelation 5, verse 5. They'll take the historical incident of the coronation of Emperor Haile Selassie, and they will connect it to some other verses scattered throughout the Hebrew Bible and the Christian scriptures, and we'll start to, before you know it, connect the dots and speak of Haile Selassie as the one who's prophesied about in the Hebrew scriptures, and they will see him as the prince who's going to come out of Ethiopia, who will lead his people into freedom and into liberty. They will see him as the black returned Messiah. They'll do a little bit of interesting hermeneutics, because in addition to the Bible as a whole, they will also read Haile Selassie's coronation through another book. So this is another example of the narrative dimension. A book that's called the Kebra Nagast, which in Amharic means glory of the kings. It's a legend cycle, really, of several centuries old, which gives an account of the Solomonic dynasty of the Ethiopian emperors, going all the way back to King Solomon and Queen Sheba, and which is a tale that's told in the Bible. And the story is, of course, that to cut a long story short, that King Solomon and Queen Sheba have a child, a male child, Menelik the First. And if you come down 225 descendants from Menelik the First, you arrive at Haile Selassie. So you can say that he's in the tribe of Judah. You can say, therefore, that he's in the Davidic line or the Solomonic line, and therefore he is a revered, if not sacred, figure. So Rastas will come forward with that and start to think of Haile Selassie as God, or to use the term that they use, Jah, J-A-H, Jah Rastafari, the living God. And then things start to sort of happen or get built around the centrality of that figure. You sort of move into rituals that are associated with him. For example, You know, the Haile Selassie is related to Solomon, as I just referenced. The legend is that ganja or marijuana, the holy herb, the herb that is for the healing of the nations, to quote from Revelation again, that holy herb was found growing on the grave of King Solomon. That's the way the tradition puts it. King Solomon, one of the things that he's famous for is that he's a wise man. Right, he's the original wise guy, and traditionally the author of Proverbs, though biblical scholars, of course, will want to question all of that. And so why smoke marijuana? Well, it's referred to as the weed of wisdom. It gives you the third eyesight. It heightens your consciousness. It gives you a sense of connectedness to Jah, which, as many Rastas pointed out to me when I first made my trip to Jamaica in 1987, you connect to Jah through smoking marijuana the way you would connect to God through Jesus Christ when you ingest bread and wine at communion or mass. It's sacramental. It's ritual in that respect. So again, you have a ritual dimension to the movement. You could go on here in terms of the ethics that are associated with Haile Selassie, the peace and love idea, and so on. Just a couple of the dimensions.
Yeah, I think that's helpful to get people into a little bit of the tradition. Your book is great because while there's been quite a bit of scholarship on Rastafari, very often it focuses on music. And while you look at music, you take a different angle, but you look at the arts more generally. And you begin with literature, which certainly you explore in your research more broadly, so it makes a lot of sense. Can you give us a little bit of sense of the literary arts in relation to Rastafari? You look at several books in detailed analysis. What's the range of work we find? What does it tell us about Rastafari? What can we learn from this literature?
Sure, good question. One of the things that I wanted to do was, of course, acknowledge how reggae has helped place Rastafari on the world's cultural map. And I mentioned Bob Marley earlier. There's a lot more to reggae than Bob Marley, of course, but he has to be given his due. And I tried to do that in various places. And I also tried to introduce the reader to some other musicians, both dub poets like Benjamin Zephaniah, whom I mentioned, and then rising vocalists like Asante Amen in Jamaica. And then musicians from further afield, a Black Rasta, who's a radio DJ and a self-proclaimed Rasta Muslim in Accra in Ghana, and his compatriot Rocky Dawuni, who is kind of goes back and forth from Ghana and California, where he's based. And then even some musicians in Japan as well. Reggae has to be acknowledged then, but you're quite right that there's, if you're going to speak of Rastafari and the arts, then, to try and render that as broadly as possible. That was part of my aim. And so I started really with literary art as well, and including that dub poetry, of which there is a very, very strong tradition. Individuals like Mikey Smith, who was one of the foremost dub poets in the 1980s. He was, would mix these militant poetic kind of Molotov cocktails and then throw them out to the audience from time to time. It got him into a lot of trouble with the political and social authorities of his day, because he questioned the, what I guess we would call structural racism today. He was one of the poets who was basically saying that Jamaican black lives matter, I guess, back in the 1980s, and really challenging the political structures, of which there are just two main parties, really, in Jamaica. That got him into a lot of trouble with ordinary folk as well, and he was sadly and rather tragically killed by a rather indignant mob and who stoned him to death. And other poets have picked up on that kind of mythical and yet historical moment in dub poetry history. Other poets, probably more famous because they've toured the United States, folk like Muta Baruka and Jean Binta Breeze. What you see in Muta Baruka is a really interesting poet who's also an actor in Jamaica, and to see him live is to see a rather dramatic performance. He's certainly working with the stage rather than the page in mind, which is, I think, true of a great many Rastafari dub poets. He kind of strides across the stage like some Old Testament prophet, sort of delivering his righteous wail against, again, some of the issues that Mikey Smith was interested in and sort of found troubling. Jean Binta Breeze kind of adds a new dimension to it, because anyone who studies Rastafari, at least from its earliest inception, would recognize that here's a rather strongly patriarchal religious movement. And for the first few decades, that's how it was. I mean, Rastas in the early days were very adamant about reading scriptures literally rather than, let's say, allegorically. And when they got to various passages in Numbers and Leviticus about a woman being, let's say, unclean during her menstrual cycle, Rastafari men were very, very clear about what that meant for them ethically. And as a result, women, you know, for all sorts of reasons beyond simply the menstrual cycle reason, were prohibited from full involvement within the movement. But over time, I think what's happened is more and more Rastafari women have found their voice. There's kind of a, if you can think of how womanism functions within African-American religion, in some ways, there's a kind of Rasta womanism too. And Barbara McCady Blake-Hannah, whom I mentioned a little earlier, she's probably the primary spokesperson for that, the first wave, I guess, if you want to use some of that nomenclature, who push back against the treatment of women. And poets like Jean Binta Breeze, who was recently awarded the MBE by Her Majesty the Queen for her contributions to poetry. So think just for a minute just how far the Rastafari have come if the Queen Elizabeth II is recognizing them. Jean Binta Breeze is someone who's put gender and Rasta on the world's cultural map through her poetry. Quite acerbic in her poetry, but a delightful woman in real life. And so she's part of that literary tradition. If you sort of jump over to novels, those novels have been written mostly by a combination of outsiders and insiders. There are more insiders writing novels that feature Rastafari as characters these days than outsiders. But there's a nice balance, hopefully, in my book. I kind of start with two outsiders. Roger May's novel, Brother Man, published in the early 50s, and then Orlando Patterson's The Children of Sisyphus, which was published in the early 60s, both of them kind of landmark texts because they offer rather, in different ways, they offer rather sensitive portrayals of the Rastafari at a time when in society the Rastafari were being met with all kinds of critique from the social and political authorities of the day. And both novels predate the 1966 official state visit to Jamaica by His Imperial Majesty Haile Selassie, which was a game changer for the Rastafari and the social perception of the Rastafari among ordinary Jamaicans. So those two are really, really important novels. If you come forward in time, and again, to cut a long story short, you get novels by storytellers like Barbara McCady Blake-Hannah, who wrote a kind of a thinly disguised portrait of Bob Marley in her novel Joseph, which is subtitled a Rasta Reggae Fable, I think is the title. And that's a really fascinating novel about a musician who learns to deal with Babylon in the language of Rastafari, the kind of corrupt Western social system symbolized by the recording industry in many ways. And then if you come forward in time, you also get Canadian Rastafari women like Masani Montague, who write a novel really just solely and utterly about one woman's spiritual pilgrimage as a Rasta woman, which again tells us something about how women are finding their voice, both in fiction as well as in life. One of my good friends, Jeffrey Phillip, who's a creative writing instructor, one of Jamaica's finest novelists. He's a creative writing instructor based in Florida, written a really interesting novel that kind of uses Dante's Inferno as his kind of template, sets the story, a modern story in Jamaica, and then has characters kind of a descend through their own hell with their own Virgil. And the Virgil is here played by, the Virgil character is played here by a Rastafarian. So it's kind of an interesting fictional transfiguration of Dante's story, only with Rastafari in the hell that is certain sections of modern Jamaica. So there are lots and lots of novels that feature Rastafari. I could only squeeze a few in there.
Yeah. And I think what you do show us is that there is a greater appreciation of this work. And just this past year, Marlon James wrote this very popular book, A Brief History of Seven Killings, which probably was too late of a publication to look at for this book. Have you looked at that at all yet?
Yes. It's a fine novel. It's a very ambitious kind of sprawling epic of a novel. It would probably taken up an entire chapter all by itself. But yeah, I have an end note in here in the book here and there referencing that. But I yes, you're right. It came in too late for me to really do it justice. But it's a fine novel.
Yeah, and this is probably the most widely acclaimed, so hopefully I'll give you some more work to do down the road.
Absolutely.
You've talked a little bit about some of these dub poets, but I'm wondering perhaps if people still might not even know what that is. We know what poetry is, but what exactly are some of the dynamics happening with dub poets? What makes them different than the tradition of poetry that people might be more familiar with?
Okay, well, one way to sort of pitch it is to sort of say, well, when we take our English literature classes, most of us sort of learn to distinguish between an epic poem and a sonnet, for example. We understand how the sound and sense and the structure of those poems are, you know, easy to distinguish or easy to identify over time, of course. And we learn who the great and the good are in terms of the writers or the architects of those types of poems. Dub poetry is kind of an interesting phenomenon. It's not as though it's not that the dub poets do not have a structure to their poems. They do. It's just that early dub poetry, the sort that I became interested in, like Mikey Smith, like Muta Baruka, and to a certain extent Benjamin Zephaniah and Jean Bentabreeze, all of them featured in my book, they sort of work, again, less with the page in mind. So they're not sort of sitting down in an ivory tower somewhere as a high-flying intellectual sort of trying to compose poems. They work with the stage rather than the page in mind. So that's one thing. These are performance poets. Dub actually takes its name really from a musical term. When reggae artists in the 60s and 70s would record a single, to save money on studio time expenses, what they would do is they would record a vocal version of their song, and then typically they would then, for the B-side of the 45, this is showing my age here, though vinyl is back in fashion, they tell me, for the B-side of a 45 single, they would take the same vocal song, but they would strip it of its vocals and then start adding distortions, dropouts, equalizations, reverb, you name it. And they would call that subsequent B-side the dub version. So there'd be all kinds of, you know, sometimes extra vocals that would be added to it that would then be, that would have an echo or a reverb on it that would make it sound sonically rather fascinating. And some record producers just became, you know, quite famous for this. And Lee Scratch Perry is one of them, for example. King Tubby is another. The Scientist is another. They all made these dub versions and became quite famous for it. Well, the dub poets kind of take their name from some of that, because they would, in later versions of those dub mixes, would often add their own poetry on top of the music, and on top of the original song. And that dub style became quite popular in the United States and in the United Kingdom much later in the 80s, and sort of really was very influential with early rap and early hip hop, and so on. So the dub poets kind of take their cue from the musical side of things. They work with the stage and not just the page in mind. They also have a very strong social dimensional component to their poetry, excuse me. And I guess here what you have to do is kind of put this in kind of a colonial context. Jamaica is a former Commonwealth country. Its educational system was based upon the educational system that I was familiar with. The British educators that came over to Jamaica ran secondary modern high schools there the way they did in the United Kingdom. And when I first learned poetry, of course, I learned nursery rhymes. And, you know, a lot of those nursery rhymes would have been rather strange, I'm sure, to Jamaicans. And what you find with some of the early dub poetry is there are twists on those colonial nursery rhymes, twists that draw attention to disparities in race, class, and gender, and are in the way in which they draw attention to those disparities, they are pointed critiques of the British colonial system and of the social injustices that Jamaican black women, men, children have had to put up with for many, many decades, both pre and post independence. And so there's this strong social dimension, this kind of an attempt to take, as Rastas would call it, Babylon, in the language of Rastafari, to take Babylon and kind of grab it and put it in a poetic headlock. That's what I think poets like Muta Baruka and Benjamin Zephaniah and others are trying to do. So the social dimension, there's almost a militantly social come religious dimension, because, again, to look at someone like Benjamin Zephaniah striding across the stage, flashing his dreadlocks, is to see almost a kind of an Ezekiel figure or an Amos, asking for justice to flow like an everlasting stream, but justice for all, not just for those at the top.
You also look at film, and you briefly discuss popular film, but then you focus on documentary film. So could you maybe just kind of set us up briefly with how Rastas are represented in Hollywood film, and then why you feel an examination of documentaries is more fruitful for your work?
Thanks. I There is some scholarship out there, very, very fine scholarship, actually, on the treatment of Rastafari in popular film, in Hollywood movies. Everything from, of course, everybody would know this, Cool Runnings, right through to, you know, Club Paradise and other films, New Jack City. There's some fine scholarship out there. I didn't want to simply rehearse that scholarship and make my own critique. So the bottom line, really, on the scholarship on those films is that the treatment of Rastafari is really quite abysmal. I mean, stereotypical and really not very informative or very insightful. So I in my chapter on what I call the real Rasta, it begins with a kind of a very brief survey of some of that scholarship and a nod and a wink to some of those films. You know, even there's the Shark's Tale actually has those two, you know, kind of jellyfish who have tentacles that look like dreadlocks and are wearing a tam and then are kind of thugs, really, yardies, I guess you'd call them in Jamaican parlance for gangsters who are helping out one of the characters in that children's animation. The treatment is just not great. So I wanted to find something that hadn't been done, at least in a comprehensive way, and that was to sort of look at some of the documentary films. There's a growing list of them out there, and I could only really do a kind of historical survey, start with some of the early ones and then move forward to one of the more recent ones, which of course was Kevin MacDonald's wonderful biopic on Marley, which really does stress how he is a global ambassador for the movement as well as for the genre of reggae music. But I really wanted to track historically the way in which those documentaries tell us something about the movement at the particular time in which they are being filmed or when they are released. And so I have an early documentary that looks at the treatment of Rastafari women, and that was released in the early 1990s. And then I come forward to include one that appeared in the mid 2000s, which is Monica Hyams' fabulous documentary film called Awake Zion, which she's a practicing Jew, and she was very interested, of course, in the connections between Judaism on the one hand and Rastafari on the other. She was living in Crown Heights in Brooklyn and noticed that there were, of course, in addition to lots of Orthodox Jews in the neighborhood, there were also quite a lot of Rastafari, and so she started exploring some of the connections. She's very good friends with Mattis Yah, who, of course, is an aesthetic reggae singer, and very good friends with some other folk who appear in her documentary. And so she explored some of the links and went to Jamaica herself and then went to Israel to explore the reggae scene in Tel Aviv and elsewhere, and came out with a fabulous documentary that really does pick up on something that I mentioned earlier when I was describing or explaining Haile Selassie's significance to the Rastafari. If you recall, I sort of went through the Solomonic dynasty and how he's at the tribe of Judah. Well, there's at least one of those connections with Judaism, and she explores many more besides, and she was very gracious in granting me an interview where we explored some of those connections and a bit more beside. So that was very helpful.
You also look at Rastafari in places where people might not expect it to be. And you both kind of give us a glimpse at some of the scholarship that's been going on. But you also give some insight from your own travels and ethnographic work. Can you tell us about this globalization of Rastafari?
Sure. So the movement is traceable to this November 1930 coronation of His Imperial Majesty Haile Selassie. And so if you come forward in time, it's over 80 years or so. And the movement has really blossomed and mushroomed. It's almost like a forest fire in summertime, if you'll forgive the mixed metaphors here. But it's probably easier to say where the Rastafari do not have a presence than rather to sort of catalog where the Rastafari are these days. My research, much of it ethnographic, has taken me to, you know, not just the United Kingdom, but the United States, and then to West Africa, where I've done some work on Rastafari in Ghana, and also in Senegal, and then most recently in Japan, where there are Rastafari up in the hills outside of Kyoto, who have a rather interesting way of, as they do wherever they find themselves, of combining or blending, or I guess syncretizing elements of local or host culture. In this case, it would be Zen Buddhism with basic or fairly rudimentary Rastafari beliefs. Rastafari are what Rastafari do, and they do lots of different things wherever you find them in the world. And, you know, so you can find, and I didn't write too much about this in my book because, like the Marlon James novel, it came a little bit too late in my research activities to sort of squeeze it into the book. But I really want to write about this. When I was in Senegal, I met some Rastafari Muslims, followers of the Bai Fall, who were really fascinating individuals to connect to, because in their own lives they were trying to embody and balance this desire or devotion to kind of mystical Sufi form of Islam in Senegal, which is hugely popular, with, again, some fairly basic Rastafari beliefs, with some fascinating results. But I'm still trying to process a lot of that. In Japan, some of the Rastafari that I found there were similar to the Rastafari that my good friend Marvin Sterling, who is a professor of anthropology up at Indiana, he wrote a book that Duke published a few years ago called Babylon East, which is really about reggae, dancehall, and the Rastafari in Japan. It's an extremely erudite and insightful book. And so I kind of built on some of my own work and surveyed some of Marvin's work, and then had an interview with Marvin at the end of the book where he kind of fleshed out some of his answers to some of the questions I had about not only his work, but the Rastafari in that far-flung part of the world. So, yeah, I do think that anyone who studies Rastafari moving forward has to take seriously the kind of internationalization of the movement. Social media and music and migratory patterns have made all of that possible, the globalization of Rastafari. And it's radically redrawing how we understand the African diaspora, because basically if Rastafari shows up in lots of different parts of the world, in former Soviet states, right through to New Zealand and other parts, I mean Brazil, then the African diaspora is practically everywhere. We're having to rethink what that really truly means.
You finished the book thinking about the commodification of Rastafari, and this is happening both from insiders and from outsiders. So can you help us understand this dichotomy between the anti-capitalist perspective that's very dominant in the Rastafari tradition and this contemporary consumer-driven manifestation of its commodification?
Sure. It's something that I wanted to include in the book. You'll very quickly get to the edges of my thinking on this one, however, because it is just really an epilogue in the book. It's kind of where I'd like to go next if I have the time, and where I think scholars, both insiders and outsiders, should go next, because the movement is changing so rapidly. And again, social media and commercialization and the branding of the religion has a lot to do with that. So I'm very interested in the way in which a particular figure like Bob Marley has been marketed, for example. In the year just before my book appeared, you know, Marley's estate teamed up with venture capitalists to work on the legalization of marijuana, which, you know, there are moves, limited moves have been made to legalize marijuana in Jamaica, of course. And then, of course, there are many states in the United States that actually legalize it. And I think that will, you know, change and move forward with subsequent years. It's interesting how the very individuals that Bob Marley would have bewailed during his life are now the very individuals that his family are getting terribly close to, the venture capitalists, because capitalism, if you go back through Bob Marley's discography, and there's a fine book by Dean McNeil on the Bible and Bob Marley, which tracks all of this quite superbly. If you look at Bob Marley's discography, you find that there's an awful lot of anti-capitalist, you know, sort of social message in there, a lot of anti-capitalist invective, and it's all there in his critique of this term Babylon. So it's interesting to me to see that with the global spread of the movement and the post-Marley possibilities for the movement involve the use of Marley in the branding of the religion. Now, you know, I as an outsider can comment on that. I can maybe championing it at certain points. I can maybe lament it at certain points. I can only go so far, or I feel I can only go so far as an outsider. As I end that epilogue, I sort of say it's really going to be up for insiders in the movement to sort of wonder out loud, not only about the marketing of Bob Marley, but also about the co-option of Rastafari myths, symbols, and rituals for usage in a whole host of things. And anyone who goes to my personal website will see that I've mounted a whole series of images that will give you, in all of the wonderful colors of red, gold, and green, the many, many examples, everything from shot glasses right through to lava lamps through to plush toys, you name it. There's something that has Rastafari symbolism attached to it. Now, is that a good thing or is it a bad thing? I, as an outsider, sort of, you know, have my reservations. In other ways, I guess it actually puts it out there in the marketplace, pun intended, and gets people asking questions the way I asked questions when I was, 10-year-old listening to reggae. And hopefully those questions get answered by people who are informed. But it is fascinating how the religion has become branded and commodified in such a way that you can find even. And I encourage your listeners to do this. You might sort of, there's an SNL short is called Raz Trent. It's all about a white guy, a Trustafarian, I guess you'd want to call him, who goes to college and acquires Rastafari as a way of getting into his kind of rebellion against his parents, and it's an example of how modern affluent white individuals are taking to Rasta.
Well, Darren, we've taken a lot of your time, and thanks for talking about this wonderful book. Sure. Before I let you go, can you just give us an idea of what kind of things you're working on now? We know you're very busy and publishing lots of things in various places, so.
Sure. I try to do something different when I've finished a monograph like that. And what I'm working on at the moment is an edited volume with my wife, who's an American religious historian, here at TCU. I'm trying to work on a volume of essays that'll really track the history of the evangelical novel. you know, look at some of the novels that have really been quite powerful in shaping the conservative evangelical Christian imagination over the years. Of course, the Left Behind series of novels becomes a really good example of that. I'm quite fascinated by the figure of Johnny Cash, who, of course, appeared with Billy Graham at many of his revivals. And you think of how Billy Graham harnessed popular culture to brand a certain form of conservative evangelicalism. That's quite powerful, quite interesting. And one of the lesser known things about Johnny Cash, one of the few things that actually is really known by a lot of people about Johnny Cash, is that he actually wrote a novel about the Apostle Paul called The Man in White. Everybody knows, of course, that Johnny Cash was referred to as The Man in Black. He wrote this novel about the Apostle Paul called The Man in White. He also actually had a film called The Gospel Road, which is filmed on location in Israel, and Johnny Cash is in it. But it's this novel that's really interesting to me, because if you track the parallels between the Apostle Paul, such as we know him as a figure in history, and then Johnny Cash, it is quite amazing what those parallels are. And so I'm hoping to write a book chapter on that that'll situate itself in this much larger collection of essays on that'll put me in the company of some really heavy-hitting American religious historians, a volume that'll look at the history of the evangelical novel.
Sounds great. Well, good luck, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Christian.
That was my conversation with Darren Middleton about his great new book, Rastafari and the Arts, An Introduction, published with Routledge in 2015. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion.